Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 353, I chat with calibrator Dave Abrams about the Sony A1E OLED TV. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded May 11th, 2017. Episode 353, Sony A1E OLED TV. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is David Abrams, calibrator extraordinaire and president of Avical here in Southern California. Hey, Dave, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Oh, always happy to have you here because we always have great discussions. Those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv. And you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Always helps if you use my screen name, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or anything like that, somewhere in the message, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen, and I can see it more easily. So Dave and I are starting a new project that I think everyone, all of my audience here, will be very happy to hear about. We're going to be taking a look at TVs as we move forward, different ones, and reporting our findings right here on Home Theater Geeks. The first part of that process will be in Dave's studio. In fact, the whole thing will be taking place in Dave's studio. But he's going to be taking the measurements, doing the calibrations, talking with me about what he finds. And then I'm going to be looking at content. Dave, of course, will be looking at content as well. And I'll be writing it up on AVS, and we'll be talking about it here on Home Theater Geeks. So it's going to be really, really fun, and we're going to be looking at higher-end TVs. So, you know, it's going to be on the expensive side of things, but, you know, we're geeks. We want to hear about what's the best that's out there, right? So this is our first entry into that process. We're going to be talking about the Sony A1E OLED. But before we get into that, I'd like, Dave, for you to tell us a little bit about your studio, how you set it up, the wall color, the lights. You know, it's I've been there, and I know that it's a really nice place to be looking at video. But tell us about how you put it together.
Sure, Scott. So we wanted a place that we could control the light. So, of course, it doesn't have any windows. So sometimes you find yourself there at 3 a.m. and you don't realize it's 3 a.m. But it's really nice in that way. We have black tile throughout the studio, as well as some GTI. I had to look this up here one sec. GTI Munsell neutral gray paint. And I think I was trying to remember before the podcast, I think we went with N7 because it's a little bit lighter. And the lab isn't very large, as you've seen. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't make it fully black, because then you'd think you were just in a black hole. But the ceiling, you know, the ceiling we made black. We hung black fabric over it. And then again, the black tiles, the gray wall. So you're really in a black and, a grayscale of a room. Mm-hmm. And even the desks are black and gray, and the chairs are, you know, stainless steel and gray. And
you're a man after my own heart. I did the same thing when I worked at Sound and Vision. Well, I worked at Home Theater Magazine. And I established a studio that did exactly the same thing. You worked in there for a while when it was with Perfect Vision.
Yeah.
I did the same thing. I painted the walls Munsell gray. I think I painted mine a little darker than you did. My home theater is the same. It's a little darker, but it's Munsell gray, which is very neutral. It has no hue in it, so that whatever light is reflected from it is reflected accurately, so to speak. It is not given a hue of any sort. So, you know, that's super geeky, but hey, this is Home Theater Geeks. So
that's what it's all about.
That's what it's all about. So black floor, neutral gray, Munsell, what's called Munsell gray. And my my home theater, I think, is at 9% reflectivity. I don't remember the end number. Yours is a little bit lighter than that, but not much. And the reason, of course, as I said, is it's so that light, any light that is reflected around, isn't distorted in its color.
Yes, and then we went with the Philips Hue system throughout the office, and then and then we took the reflectance standard, the photo research reflectance standard, and calibrated the light to D65 as close as we could get it.
I love that. And, you know, and those are LED lights. The color is controllable. How accurately did you get to D65 with those lights? I'm curious to know. I've never used them myself.
So we were measuring about, I think it was 315-330 or 311, right? Really close to D65. And it does look pretty good off the paint. I've always wanted to take a little more time with it and see if we could put up some our reference OLED, right? The RGB OLED that we have in the office is the standard, and sort of put white up on there and then perceptually see if we could match the light, maybe even a little closer to the spectral response of the OLED so they're really in sync with each other. But I just haven't had the time.
By the way, the numbers that Dave just said were the coordinates in the CIE chart where the point of white is. And D65 is 313329. And you got, what did you say again?
I think we had about 315-330, 331, right around there.
Oh, man. So it's like one or two thousandths off. So that's good enough for me.
Yeah, and you know, I bet you I could get it a little faster, a little closer, except when you're adjusting the Philips Hue system, it's not like the finest of things in the app to kind of drop, you know, the slider, and you're adjusting the coordinates. I think they've updated that, though, so maybe I should take another look at it. Maybe we can get it dead on.
Well, I know you and I are very much the same in that we want to get things as dead on as possible, even calibrations, which, as long as you're under a certain error, which we'll talk about during this in this show, then it's said to be indistinguishable from completely correct. But even so, I try to get my errors down as low as possible, and I know you do too. So we're brothers in that respect as well. Now, you mentioned your reference OLED monitor, which you have there to compare to other TVs and monitors that come in. Tell us a little bit about that reference monitor.
So we went with the Flanders Scientific, which, if you're in the broadcast world, it's a pretty popular brand. They take the Sony RGB OLED, the broadcast OLED that's used throughout most of Hollywood at this point, and put it in their own chassis, sort of like Sony with the A1E has purchased the LG Glass, right? And they take the LG Glass OLED, they put it in, they put their image processing behind it, they put their inputs behind it, their software. And that's what Flanders does on the broadcast side. And they do a really phenomenal job of it. One of the things we like is you can pretty much calibrate it to any standard that you want through either a 1D LUT or a 3D LUT or both, right? So you have a lot of flexibility in it. And we wanted to have something that was really a reference grade monitor that just performed above the rest. And again, this is one of the monitors that a lot of content is being mastered on in Hollywood. So to have that in the office as our reference when we're comparing other displays really helps a lot to see how things fare up against sort of, you know, the holy grail of displays.
Sure. Well, and as I've said many times, the goal of a consumer TV is to reproduce what the director or the colorist or whoever worked on the content, what they saw in their studio. So if you can get a consumer TV to look the same as a professional monitor, such as they would use in the mastering suite, grading suite, then you're golden. That's exactly what you need.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to have it is, again, you know, we have some monitors that come in and out of here from time to time, and we want to make sure that, okay, we see how well it performs in the measurements, but how does it look perceptually to one of these reference monitors? And sometimes, you know, you're impressed and sometimes you're a little disappointed of, oh, wow, you know, it measured so well, but that contrast just doesn't line up with the OLED, or, you know, I noticed the color shifting against the panel. You can really see against the the OLED and the great uniformity that that has. So those types of things can really become more apparent when you have that reference right next to the monitor.
Well, it's going to be great to, and we did do that, in fact, with the Sony OLED, and we'll get into that. But it's great to have that sort of reference sitting there next to. Now, the Flanders monitor is smaller. It's what, 30 inches?
25 inches.
So it's pretty small compared to TVs.
Yeah, it's pretty small. And I think it retails for about $8,500. So it gives you an idea of how much these run, a 25-inch monitor for $8,500.
Yeah.
It's pricey.
Anybody tried to sell a consumer TV 25-inch for $8,500, well, they wouldn't get any takers. But that means that the Sony itself, the Sony X300, which is a 30-inch OLED, RGB OLED, is, I don't remember, but it's certainly in the five figures.
I believe the BVM X300 is $42,000 on the price sheet as retail, but I think they go for about $29,000 on the market. I think you find them right around $29,000 for the BVM X300, which is 30 inches, right? 30 inches, 4K, right. HDR.
Yep. Yep.
Beautiful monitor, just calibrated one this morning. I love that thing. And but yeah, it's pricey. It's about $1,000 an inch.
Man. Oh, that brings that, though, the thinking about calibration, though, brings me to UJ's question here in the chat room. So how is the reference monitor calibrated? It's calibrated in the same way that you would calibrate any video display, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's calibrated the same, right, to the same targets and the same standards that we're trying to do with every display, except with broadcast monitors, we're seeing a larger shift towards 3D lookup tables and 1D lookup tables. So instead of going in and, say, adjusting your RGB bias or gain controls for, say, 2-point grayscale or even a 10-point grayscale in something like the Sony A1E, you're able to profile the monitor. So you basically make a bunch of measurements, anywhere from maybe 100 to 10,000 measurements of the display, get its color profile, and then through software, you calculate what's called a lookup table, a conversion table. Think of it as EQ for your display, right? You have your treble, your bass, your mid, but you have a lot of these, a whole slew of adjustments that you can use.
It's like a really fine graphic EQ, shall we say.
Exactly. So you calculate that, you load it, and then you test against it, right? So then you run your test patterns in and you try to figure out, okay, well, now am I hitting the target that I want to hit? And if you are, then you're calibrated. And if not, you got to take a step back and see what might have gone wrong. The only thing I don't like about lookup tables and doing this type of calibration is it can hiccup. You can get a point where you don't have enough pattern delay, or your computer kind of gets out of sync with your generator because it puts up a pattern, it takes a reading, and then it logs the data. And if you get out of sync or something isn't quite right, you often don't know until you actually go to compile and look at your LUT. So you could actually take on the older LG OLEDs, when we were building lookup tables for them, we would take about 10,000 measurements, and that would take about 3.5 hours approximately with the equipment we have.
Which is an automated process, though, right? I mean, you set it up, and then you go get dinner and you come back 3.5 hours later, right?
Absolutely, yes. You can set it up, go get dinner, come back 3 hours later. But if it goes wrong, then you got to find out what went wrong and then start it over. So there's no like going back to the middle, whereas where you're calibrating, let's say, a 10-point grayscale, you know, you get a bad reading or something doesn't look right, you just remeasure it and readjust it. You don't have to keep going back and forth, you know, with hours and hours involved in it.
Right. Right. Exactly. But there are some consumers, certainly on viewers of Home Theater Geeks and AVS Forum, who actually use LUTs, lookup tables, for their consumer displays, either in software or more likely in a hardware box. Because you can buy a hardware box that provides these LUTs, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I see a lot of clients here in Los Angeles with the Lumigen video processor. So, and that's an excellent LUT box. You know, it's something that not only does your video switching and scaling, but it also allows you to do lookup tables and, you know, their CMS, right, their color management system, which can be as simple as just adjusting some grayscale, or it can be as complex as loading a 3D table into it.
Yeah. One other thing we should mention, make sure that people know about the Flanders reference monitor, is it can be calibrated to within an inch of its life for grayscale and color, but it's 1080p, not 4K, right?
Absolutely. Yes, it is 1080p. The only 4K broadcast OLED is that BVM X300. And I just haven't been able to save up that $30,000 to put that in the office.
I don't blame you for that. Also, the Flanders is not high dynamic range, or is it?
So it has a HDR emulation mode in it. It does about 300 to 350 nits, the panel that I have, and you're able to calibrate it for HDR, but it, you know, again, it'll stop out at 350 nits, which a lot of people would say it's not real HDR. You need closer to 1,000 nits or more to say, oh, I have an HDR, especially when you're mastering content. You really need something at least 1,000 nits or higher when you're grading content. So you could get an idea of maybe what it'll look like in HDR on the Flanders, but it's certainly not a reference grade HDR monitor
for that reason. People aren't grading content in HDR on the Flanders monitor.
Not on the one I have in the office, not on the DM250. Now right, at NAB, Flanders announced a 31-inch LCD that'll hit 2,000 nits that's shipping later this year. So maybe after this podcast, they'll be inclined to send us a demo unit. Scott will be able to take a look.
I'll work on that, sure. But to your point, even consumer OLEDs today cannot hit 1,000 nits. They're up in the 500, 600, 700 range. LG claims 1,000, but whether or not they can actually hit it is a good question.
So that is a great question. So when we were at NAB, we talked to a couple of the manufacturers that have claimed 1,000 nits off the OLEDs. And, you know, one of the engineers was pretty straight with me. He says, you know how we do it? We do a smaller window. You know, it's 3% window, you know, and you'll get 1,000 nits out of the OLED. Just, you know, take whatever OLED you have. Doesn't matter. He was telling me, he's like, doesn't matter if it's LG or the Sony, you can manipulate it, you know, with a smaller window to get it to kick up to about 1,000 nits. So I haven't seen every single one of, you know, every model OLED out there, right? But and I haven't measured them all with a 3% window, but that's when they're claiming 1,000 nits on a consumer OLED. They're most likely measuring it with a smaller window from what we've been told.
This kind of reminds me of amplifier power measurements, where they measure at one specific frequency, typically 1 kilohertz, to get a power number, but that doesn't really reflect what happens when it's reproducing 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. So it's more kind of manufacturer manipulation of the data to hit a certain number. But it's a little misleading, it seems to me, in some cases.
Absolutely. I mean, it can be misleading for sure. And you also have to remember, you know, the argument that you hear at all the SMPTE meetings and everyone saying, you know, contrast is so important. And so you see some of these monitors that can do 1,000 nits or 1,500 nits, but they don't have the black level of an OLED. So you don't have as much perceived contrast as you may have with the OLED at times. You know, there are some LCDs out there that are phenomenal. You know, the Sony Z9D, phenomenal. Yeah. You know, love that set. It's amazing. But there are certainly some that play the game, right? So there's some sets on the market, middle cost, lower cost sets that will hit a really high light output really quickly. And then if you try to hold that white window up on the screen for more than a second or two, you know, you see it start to dim. Or vice versa, you'll see some, you know, the backlight kind of catch up and you'll see it be a little low really initially, and then you'll see it get a little brighter as it sits on the screen for a few minutes and the backlight kind of cranks up. So there's certainly some games that are being played, and, you know, there's engineering reasons and there's cost reasons, and, you know, it's not like manufacturers are trying to pull one over on anyone really specifically, but energy regulations and then heat issues and power issues and cost issues, right, all become a bigger problem. And even at NAB, I think we might have mentioned on the podcast the other day,
a couple of weeks ago,
we talked about some of these monitors, that 31-inch LCD that's 2,000 nits. I'm going, well, when are we going to see this in a consumer product? And the answer from the manufacturer was, when we can get liquid cooling into the panel. You know, and he goes, and the reason isn't that we can't get the liquid cooling in it. The problem is people don't think people are going to want to buy a thicker flat panel because we've made them so thin, right? They keep getting thinner and thinner and thinner. Yeah. And if you start like liquid cooling, and all of a sudden they're going to get thicker and thicker and thicker. And so it's, wait, we're going backwards. Now they're getting uglier. Why are we doing this?
Yeah, but they got, now they've got a radiator in them.
That's right. That's right.
Jeez. Jeez Louise. Okay, well, so now we've set the stage. We know we have a very good environment with the properly painted walls and ceiling and lighting and a reference monitor sitting right next to the TV that we are investigating. And the first one that we want to talk about here is the Sony A1E OLED. So this is an OLED TV, OLED, organic light emitting diode. Is the technology name. We call it OLED or OLED. And it uses an LG panel, as you mentioned before, which basically means it's the OLED material. OLED material glows. It emits light directly upon electrical stimulation. And the Sony broadcast monitor, the BVM X300 and the Flanders, have red, green, and blue OLED material. So little piece of OLED material glows red, another one glows green, another one glows blue. And three of those form a pixel. With the LGs, however, it's white OLED material. It glows white. And then they put red, green, and blue filters in front of the little tiny subpixels, just like an LCD TV. And they also leave one little tiny subpixel clear so that the white shines through. So it's sometimes called a WOLED or white OLED because it has an extra white subpixel. The reason being, as far as I've come to understand, is so that it can get brighter. If you have a white subpixel and it and you want to churn out as much light as possible, you crank that guy up as well as the R, G, and B, and you're going to get more peak brightness out of it. So as, at least that's my understanding. Do you have, is that your understanding as well, Dave?
Yes, that's my understanding as well, that they need the white subpixel in order to let a little bit more of that natural light from the panel through the system to get it brighter.
Mm-hmm. So that's what that's the first thing we started looking at. And before we talk about the results of that particular set, I also wanted to just sort of go over your measurement protocols. And we're in the process, you and I, of defining exactly what the protocol is going to be going forward. This is our first project together, and there will be many more. But tell us a bit about sort of the general way you approach measuring TVs.
Well, generally, I think, you know, the first step's always starting with finding the best picture mode, right? You want to try and find the most accurate picture mode and or the picture mode that allows you to get the most accurate picture. So some picture modes may not have as many adjustments as other picture modes. So the first thing is getting it out of the box, you know, burning it in. You want to get a little wear and tear on it, making sure it's software updated, making sure everything's in order with it. And then going through the process of, okay, well, let's look at, you know, you can usually tell something like Vivid is probably not going to be your ideally calibrated mode.
That'll not be my first choice generally, no.
No, you can usually tell that pretty quickly. But, you know, if it gets close, you start making the measurements. You start saying, okay, well, where's my grayscale here? How's my color gamut mapping going? Do I have any range? Do I have any adjustments? You may find a mode where you go, oh, this mode might look good, but I don't have any grayscale adjustments. I can't adjust the grayscale. So, okay, let me find the mode that's now going to let me do that. And then in some sets you might find there's actually more. And I think what I'm seeing more and more in the industry is memories like Vivid and sports and movie, for the most part, are starting to just become a name for memory one, memory two, memory three, meaning a lot of these modes have all the adjustments in them, and you simply have different starting points from them. And you can almost get most of them to match. Now, there are some things in some TVs and some settings where, yeah, there's an underlying process happening outside of the user menu, maybe in the factory menu, or even, maybe even more deep, something you can't get to. That's maybe a specific lookup table or color table in that Vivid mode that you simply can't adjust. But in a lot of TVs nowadays, a lot of it's being put into the user menu. And one of the things I like about Sony is they love to tell you what they're doing for the most part. So what I mean by that is, you know, when you go to color space, you can choose Rec. 709. There's no wide. There's no normal. What's normal, right? What's wide?
Yeah, exactly.
Until you measure it, you don't know. But on a Sony, and not just the A1E, but on a lot of their sets, they're very attuned to, okay, well, we're going to call that Rec. 709 because that's HD color. We're going to call that Rec. 2020 because that's ultra HD color, right? And we're going to call that one DCI-P3. It even has DCI-P3 in a consumer TV, which is awesome. I mean, I don't know how many people really need that, but it's awesome.
Well, you do need it. Yes, Ultra HD Blu-ray is specified for Rec. 2020 color, but here's a little wrinkle. At the moment, there are no TVs that can do 2020 color. They are, in fact, more closer to DCI-P3, which is the color gamut that's used in commercial cinemas. And so that's what most UHD Blu-rays are mastered to or graded to right now is DCI-P3. So why wouldn't you pick DCI-P3 if you had that choice in your color space menu? Would you always pick 2020 for a UHD Blu-ray?
Yes, Scott. So you would actually pick 2020 for the UHD Blu-ray, and here's why. So the system, the standard is Rec. 2020, and the way you kind of need to think about it, and Stacey Spears actually helped me a lot with kind of getting my mind into this different mindset, right? Like, there is no spoon, right? You know, it's you kind of have to think about it.
There is no spoon, right?
Yeah, you kind of have to think about it a little more abstractly. So the 2020 is a container, and right. You're filling that container with color. And you might only be looking at DCI P3, at the P3 color gamut, on your monitor when you're mastering, which is how a lot of stuff is being done, because that's the limit of a lot of these displays that are out there today, is the P3 color gamut.
Right.
But when they're mastering the content onto the disc, the digital bits, the data of like where that RGB, let's say triplet is, right? So let's say it's, you know, 275, 275, 275, which would be white, but let's just use that for the sake of me not having to think about what would equal what.
What would actual red be? Yeah, right.
Yeah, what would red be at, you know, 50% luminance and this and then, you know, whatever. Anyway, so If you're thinking about it that way, that is just going to map within this container. So the container is yay big, but your display can only do this
much.
But you're still putting the data in this container. You're just not putting data at these edges because there's no data to have there per se. You're only working with the P3. So the TV then looks at the container and only maps to the edge of what it has. So if that's P3, it just fills it up to P3 and ignores anything outside of it.
The container isn't completely full, shall we say, as a metaphor.
Exactly. So from the decode standpoint, if you were to decode P3, if the set's like, oh, I think this is P3, it's now going to try to map data in the 2020 format into the P3 space. So you're gonna have some conversion error there where it's not interpreting what that bit level is and where that bit level should be within the 2020 space. So on the TV, you generally want to go to that 2020 space, and then you want to allow the data wants you to go to the 2020 space, and you want to allow the display to then map that to the 2020 space as well, even though you may not get anything more than P3 from it.
Right.
So we calibrate, when a calibrator calibrates today, a lot of what we're doing is we're generating 2020 data and measuring for P3. And even at the studios, for a lot of the displays, because very few are going wider than that, for a lot of the displays that are out there, there are a couple like that PVMX300 that can go further out, and you can kind of play with it and say, I'm going to put it in 2020 and measure 2020, and you'll see what it does. But for most displays, we generate 2020, and then we set our systems, our calibration systems, to measure the P3 targets. Otherwise, you're just going to see the stuff clips out at the edge and everything scrunched together, and you can't really tell what's going on because it's being clipped out at the end.
Right, right. Okay, so you pick the right mode. You measure, you pick the right color standard. You pick the right color temperature, which in most cases on consumer TVs, I don't know about Sony. Does Sony actually specify color temperature in terms of degrees Kelvin, or do they also, like most, do cool, normal, and warm?
You know, that's a good point. Actually, Sony does do cool, normal, and warm, I think. It's I think there's a warm and maybe even a warm two. But it would be nice if they actually did put the Kelvin, wouldn't it? Maybe
we
can get
great.
Them to do that.
Maybe we can. If somebody's watching, think about that. Oddly, the color temperature mode that is usually the most accurate is the warm one.
Yes, absolutely. The most accurate mode in almost any TV on the market is one of the warm ones, right? A lot of sets now have a warm one and a warm two. We see that, oh gosh, in you know, most sets I think out there have more than one warm, but usually one of them is closer to the D65 standard white point that we're shooting for.
Right, exactly. Okay, so then, you know, you take your measurements. Now, in the case of the Sony A1E, you did not measure you tried to find the best mode, of course, but then you didn't take a full set of measurements, because in this particular case, you sort of started with this one before we had decided to do this project, and you'll do it in the future, but which modes did you find to be the most accurate?
So the modes that are most accurate are the Cinema Pro and the Custom, from what I found. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see if there was a difference really between Cinema Pro and Custom. On the Z9D, I don't know how many people know this, but when they had software updated the Z9D at some point and added the Custom mode in high dynamic range, does a hard clip. So it doesn't do any of the tone mapping that you'd get in HDR that you're supposed to do. And Sony did this very purposefully for people like myself who would like to see what things look like without the tone map turned on. And so it was a very much welcome addition, but you then have to remember that, okay, well, when I want to watch real content at home, I need to go to Cinema Pro. Now, I didn't see this on the A1E. I saw the A1E where the Cinema Pro mode and the Custom mode weren't doing a hard clip. They were doing their tone mapping and rolling off. And I'd love to get the hard clip into the A1E if there's someone that I could talk to and maybe make that happen. That'd be great. But
we should just make sure everybody understands that hard clipping and tone mapping basically means when they when they master high dynamic range content, typically it goes up to a peak brightness of 1,000 nits, or in some cases even 4,000 nits. No consumer TV can do 4,000 nits, and only some of them can do 1,000, and OLEDs typically cannot. So as the content gets brighter and brighter, the process of what's called tone mapping starts to roll off the brightness, so that it doesn't actually try to exceed what the TV can actually do. Whereas hard clipping is, it goes up to what the TV can do, and then it's just hard clipped. And that can look kind of ugly. So the tone mapping is a good thing to use when you're looking at real content. But for us geeks, it'd be nice to have a no tone mapping mode, so to speak.
And I throw out there, Scott, it would be awesome for whether it's easily accessible or whether it's like a special code or a special mode or something you have to punch into the set, but to have every display able to disable tone mapping for calibration, because you shouldn't calibrate against the tone map, right? Because the tone mapping is something that should be there, but it's purposely changing where the luminance would be for the data you're sending. So for example, you have a 1,000-nit TV, but a 4,000-nit source. Well, you can't see what's at 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 nits. So that has to be squeezed in to that 1,000 nit TV, which is where the tone mapping is doing that roll off. But if you're measuring right. that roll off, it makes it look, especially when you're doing color measurements, color gamut measurements, color volume, you'll notice that things are skewed because luminance comes into play with that. So it'd almost be beneficial from a calibration standpoint if you were able to disable the tone map, do your calibration, then turn that back on so you know, okay, I was targeting this and I got it hitting where it needs to be, and the EOTF is measuring properly and the color is measuring properly for what this set can do, and then add the tone map back in to do the compensation for the system.
Sounds like exactly the same sort of thing that when you're doing a calibration, you also want to turn off all other automatic functions, right? Like auto contrast and various things that might be in the TV's menu system. You want to turn all that off for calibration at least.
Yeah. You generally want to turn off anything that's auto, anything that's altering picture. So there's this mindset of with displays in general. So we want a display to show the picture just the way the picture was and not to add its own look and feel to the picture.
Right.
But it gets really hard with today's technology because we've got these LCDs with dynamic backlights. Well, when we master right. content, we're not using a dynamic backlight. The display is X amount of brightness and has Y gamma curve, and content creators are looking at a display that's very fixed, right? It's not changing its brightness based on a darker scene or a lighter scene.
Right.
But because these LCDs don't necessarily have the contrast that they'd have without it, it doesn't appear to be as pleasing of an image, right? And I'll agree. Like, I'll look at a set like, let's say, the Sony Z9D. You turn that local dimming off, and it's not as impressive as with the local dimming on. It looks a lot more impressive with the local dimming on. Yeah. But you don't want to necessarily fight that when you're trying to track your gamma. You don't want to measure 10% gray, 20% gray, 30% gray, and have the local dimming getting brighter and brighter, more so than the pattern is, because you want to make sure your data and your video signal is being processed properly. Then you sort of add on to that the look of the display. And so some people will try to calibrate with some of these things on because they're like, well, I'm gonna watch the picture with this turned on, so why wouldn't I try to calibrate it with it on? But my argument always is, well, you're not watching a 10% window or a 20% window or a 30% window. You're watching a very dynamic image that's changing quite a bit. And so if right. you end up picking that 10% window or 10% APL or something along those lines, it doesn't translate very realistically to all the scenes that you're going to be watching. So really what starts to make a set, and it's hard to quantify, and maybe you and I can figure out a way to quantify this in the lab and put it in our reviews, but it's hard to quantify how good is a manufacturer's dynamic backlighting algorithm, right? How good is that? And what ones are more obtrusive, right? That you're going to be more bothersome by. Like, one of the things I talk about with clients is pumping, what I call like a pumping in the display, where you'll see the display get bright and then you see the backlight get brighter, or you see the display go to a dark scene and then you see the backlight get darker. So you kind of see it pump a little bit between right. these different scenes. And that bothers me to no end. I know some people don't even notice
it.
It
bothers me too, to no end. I always turn that stuff off.
Yeah. So, but it'd be interesting to see who might do a better job and who has the least amount of obtrusiveness, the least amount, like maybe it was someone, if we can measure how fast it is or something, right. you know, we can say, oh, this dynamic backlight is 10 times faster than that dynamic backlight.
Right.
That starts to get really tough to do. And you need some pretty expensive equipment. Last time I was thinking about it to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get into the Sony then. Oh, before we do, one more thing about the Sony that I want to make sure everybody understands is this one control that turned out to be really important called extended dynamic range. Tell us what that is.
So extended dynamic range has been on these displays for quite a while, and it's something that's necessary if you're doing high dynamic range. You need to get the most light out of the set. And what it what it does, and I didn't spend a ton of time, you know, getting very specific with it, but it's changing the modulation of the display and the power regulation. And a lot of listeners might remember the ABL, right? The automatic brightness limiter of plasmas. And if you put up, let's say, a 10% window on a plasma, you measure it, you get 100 nits. You put up a full screen white, something that encompasses the entire screen, and you might get, you know, 60 nits of brightness. So you've lost, let's say, 40% of your brightness when you go to full screen white. And it's not necessarily, it's not ideal. I don't want to like make people think it's a great thing, but it's not ideal, but it's not as obtrusive as that makes it sound, because it's not as detrimental, because how often do you have a full white screen on your display? Very little, maybe an explosion or a fade to white or something along those lines. Right.
The movie, have you seen the movie, The Art of Flight? That's all in snow, and it's not completely full screen white, but there's an awful lot of bright white on the screen in many, many shots.
So it would be a little more obtrusive during The Art of Flight, but so extended dynamic range, what it's doing here is they're changing how bright the display can get, and therefore that response. So for example, we turned extended dynamic range off, and we were able to measure a 10% window, 20% window, 30% window, all at the same nit level. So let's say it was 100 nits. I think it was actually about 95 nits.
95, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was all the way up to full screen, and you didn't see any dimming down. You didn't see any modulation happening. You measured gamma, and the gamma measured perfect, and near perfect, I should say, all the way throughout. You really got a really great image, but the downside, it's only 95 nits. It's not super bright. And in a properly controlled environment like our office, it's fine. It looked great. I thought it looked awesome.
But on standard dynamic range material, on Blu-rays and broadcast, that standard dynamic range, what we've had up till recently and still do have a lot of, that's totally fine. That's supposed to be at 100 nits. So, okay, it's at 95. I'll give it 5 nits. No problem.
Yes. And one of my colleagues would say, yeah, but you got to remember that the 100 nits was based off of a certain sized broadcast monitor. And when you're talking about a 65-inch TV, well, nits is then over surface area, and you actually have more perceived light than you would have if you had a 30-inch broadcast monitor in the office that's at 100 nits, right? So it actually would look brighter overall. Mm. It would look a little brighter because you have that surface area of light and you're only measuring a small portion of it, but it's here or there. But you're right. We're talking about standard dynamic range, and the standard, the reference is 100 nits of brightness, and we're at about 95 nits of brightness, and that's after calibration. And it holds that very beautifully. Now, if you want a little more light, you're in a high ambient light room and you need a little more, well, you can get that. You can turn the extended dynamic range into low or medium or high, and the brightness goes quite a bit. I don't remember the exact number. I think it was around 250, 300, Scott.
We're going to take a look at those charts right now. In fact,
sure.
Let's take a look. We're going to skip 0 and 0 1 and go to number 1. And a lot of these graphics are going to be at different window sizes and at different extended dynamic range settings. So this one is the standard dynamic range. We're going to talk about standard dynamic range now. And this is the grayscale with XDR off at a 10% window.
Yes.
And so you tell us a little bit about what we're looking at here.
So we're looking at a 21-point grayscale. So we measured 21 points. And along the bottom there, you can see the 0, 5, 10, 15, 20. And so all the different percentages of luminance that were measured. And going up to, again, this is, so it's in nits and foot lamberts. So the first Y in candelas per meter squared is 95.45 nits. And in foot lamberts, you'll notice we had almost 86 foot lamberts. Sorry. There. And again, you'll see the gamma. We were targeting the BT1886 gamma, which on an OLED comes out to 2.4. And it was tracking, you know, average gamma was 2.4. And if we're looking at our delta E, our most delta E was 1.19. Now,
delta E, by the way, is the amount of error from the target.
using the Delta E2000 formula.
Right.
So you'll see the max delta is 1.19. Now, here's what's awesome about this. We only adjusted the gain. We didn't adjust a 10 point. We didn't need the bias. We were able to do that with just the gain.
So, and by the way, the gain is adjusting the luminance of the higher end of the brightness range for red, green, and blue. And bias is adjusting the lower end of the brightness range for red, green, and blue. And correct. We didn't adjust the bias at all. All you had to do was adjust the gain, which is really good.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what it means is the display's color science that's in there is very, very accurate, very linear, right? So you're making an adjustment at the top end, and that adjustment is now scaling down across to the bottom end fairly well. You know, if you got into the 10 point, you could probably tweak this a little better, get it below a delta of one. Now, a delta of one or less is considered perfect. Yep. Most people won't. They say that the standard observer shouldn't see a difference of a delta of one, which is why we call it one. That's when you just start to see the difference, really.
Well, and there are many people who say you won't see a difference under three.
Yeah, yeah. And I looked at a paper that was talking about 2.2, right? 2.2 delta being the just noticeable difference amount. So it varies. But again, if you can do a 1.19 max with an average of whatever that was, about 0.56 or 0.6, that's pretty impressive considering you just did the 2 point, you just did the gain of the 2 point grayscale, and you're getting that gamma. Now, of course, you set black level properly, you set your contrast properly to make sure you're not clipping, you're not crushing, you select right. The proper gamma table within the display that's going to hit that 2.4, and you go through your calibration process. But it's an extremely impressive display
Let's take a look at number one again, and then look at number two, which is exactly the same thing except with a full white window. So there's number one. Now we look at number two. And
we switched. I think we switched to the 14 point. So we're measuring 14 point. We just really did that to save time and get the idea.
All right. But still, we still have very similar results, whether it's a 10% window. And by that, we mean the window of white occupies 10% of the area of the entire screen versus the entire screen being white. And they're very, yes. very similar. You get similar peak brightness, similar gamma, similar errors. Everything's virtually the same. So for standard dynamic range, that works great. Let's take a look at numbers three and four, which are with the extended dynamic range at low. So we're going to start with low, and there it is with a 10% window, and the next one is 100%. And notice how things go a little wonky.
Yes, and you'll notice that the graphic just before with the 10% window, again, just the 1 point of delta E, grayscale, the gains, the max delta E on this 14 point is 0.97 with an average of 0.46. Again, our average gamma is 2.42 in the top left there. And we're getting now 141 nits of brightness. So we've gone up a noticeable amount in brightness, and at a 10% window, we're not seeing any real detriment to the picture. In fact, hey, the delta E's actually went a little bit down. So it does yes. fluctuate a little bit in calibrating a display and whatnot.
But then when you go to a full window, that's
when you take your hit. So you go from 141 nits, right, to 121.33 nits there on the left, it says. And you can see the gamma, of course, the average gamma shifts to a 2.14. And our max delta goes out to 3.29. And as you said, some people, a delta 3, they won't even see it. So, that delta is mostly based not on color, because the color of the grayscale is still pretty good, as you can see by the RGB balance there. But it's more the luminance that's changing, right? So we're losing that brightness. It ramps down a little.
If we go to 5 and 6, we'll see the extended dynamic range on medium. Now, here's the 10% window. Again, looking beautiful.
We up 207.2 nits, you know, so we're up over 200 nits now. Our black's still at 0.0002 nits, 2.41 gamma, and a max delta of 1.02.
And then we go to the full window, and whoa, things really blow up.
Yep, and now again, full window, we've now dropped back down to about 120 nits. brightness in our max delta now because of that luminance shift has gone up to 12.05. Again, you know, it's this is the extreme, right? So we're seeing a full white. That's going to be the extreme. It's very, again, very
rare. It's going to be rare.
And so, but you are seeing some of this energy modulation, whether it's for heat or power or you know, to avoid crazy burn-in on the display. You know, we don't know exactly why Sony did. We can hypothesize that's probably a heat issue. It's probably an energy consumption issue, and it could be a burn-in issue where they're worried about the longevity of the panel. But you know, still, it's something that if you had a high ambient light environment where you needed a little more light, well, yeah, you can get over 200 nits from this. And for a lot of content, it'll probably look pretty good. But when you start getting into really bright content, you'll start to drift away from that reference grade quality that you can get in the low or you know, better the off mode.
Better in the off mode, yeah. Moving on to the color. Now, we have, you also measured the, what we were looking at there was the grayscale, which is the, basically the, what happens when you're displaying white at different intensity levels, which is really gray, except at the top, which is white, and the bottom is called black, but it's really black to white through the grays. And how accurate is that throughout the entire brightness range? You also measured color in standard dynamic range, and we want to take a look at that. That would be 7. And it looks like we only have the window in this particular case. So here we are with extended dynamic range off, and we're looking at a 10% window. CMS stands for color management system, which actually the Sony doesn't have. It doesn't have a set of controls to change where these colors are. But nevertheless, we take a look at them and tell us what we're looking at here.
So, you know, it doesn't have the color management system that some other sets have, but it's sort of a blessing and a curse, right? If the color management is properly performed, you don't necessarily require the color management system to make further adjustments. And Sony's doing a phenomenal job with this. What we'll see is that the largest error is out in red, where if you look at the CIE chart on the right side of the page, you'll see the different dots are 25% saturation, 50% saturation, 75%, and 100% saturation that we measured. You'll see 25 and 50 are pretty good. And then once you get to 75, you start to get into the area where you're starting to get a little oversaturated. And when you get to 100% red, you're a little further out than you'd like. Again, looking at the delta E chart on the bottom right, you'll see that red is only just a little bit over 2, seems to be about 2.25 according to our max delta E. On the left side there. So, you know, again, not super high delta E off. We'd like it to be around 1 or less, of course. We'd love a perfect display. Sure. But very good. And again, this is simply there's only color and tint hue on the display itself. And I don't think we had to adjust either of them away from their default point in the Cinema Pro or custom picture modes to get those results. It kind of fell in with our brightness, our contrast, our gamma. You know, once that stuff kind of gets into place, that's sort of the underlying of how your color is going to perform. Mm-hmm. And Sony's doing an excellent job with their color mapping on this display.
No kidding. Now, if we look at 8 and 9, we will see the extended dynamic range in low in a 10% window, and also then the next one will be in a full window. So here's 10% window, and the next one is in full window. And whoa, with extended dynamic range set to even to low, the errors at different brightness levels for the different colors really shoot up, don't they? Go back to the previous one. There's the previous one. Most errors, except for that 100% red, are pretty low. And then you go to the full window, and boom, they just jump right up. They're still under 3, which is still good, but it's not as good. And then we go to the next two, and we'll take a look at when extended dynamic range is at medium. There's medium, and then at the 10% window, and then there's full at full screen. Now they're over 10. What's going on there?
You'll notice if you look at the CIE chart on the right, you'll notice that the dots are still fairly in the same place, right? They're still fairly in the boxes that we're
targeting
there.
Which are the targets, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the boxes are the targets, the dots are the measuring. You'll notice between all these charts, they don't really shift much. What you're seeing in the error is the luminance error. And you can see it on the Delta L chart, the third one down in the middle. Mm-hmm. That chart is where you're going to see more of that error kind of creeping in and causing that havoc, right? Because again, we're doing that luminance modulation that's happening in order to get that extra light output from the display. And we're also measuring the extreme. You know, this is the extreme of it. And it actually performs pretty good when you think about a lot of the displays out there that have modes such as this or dynamic backlighting modes such as this, where you can kind of crank them up and get a super high amount of light from them. But it is something that is happening. And ideally, I would love an OLED that can hit like, you know, maybe 4,000 nits in that extended dynamic range off mode. And that would be it.
Wouldn't that be awesome? That would be truly awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
One last thing in standard dynamic range before we leave, and that is number 12, which is called Color Checker. And this is a feature of SpectraCal CalMan, the software that most of us, certainly most calibrators and most TV reviewers, use to do these measurements. It's a great piece of software. They're always improving it. So here what we're looking at is what's called the Color Checker function. So tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is the, I believe SpectraCal calls it the Color Checker SG, and it has a ton of colors that are supposedly most commonly seen, right? So you'll notice that if you look at that chart on the right, you'll notice a lot of dots around the yellow, orange, reddish range. And one of the reasons there's a lot there is because that's where a lot of flesh tones live. And right. If it's one thing we can often see is off is flesh tones, right? You look at somebody, you go, I see people. It's what I do all the time when I interact in life. And I know what people should look like. And that's not how they should look like, right? So we run the color checker to get an idea of, okay, here are a lot of the common shades or ranges of colors that are out there that might cause a problem. And let's see how this is performing against that, right? So you look at the primaries and secondaries that we were just looking at with the saturation sweeps, and that only gives you the primaries and secondaries. It doesn't really show you the decoder overall and how the display is mapping from point A to point B. And realistically, you'd even measure more than just this if you were really trying to measure like color volume and things within a display. And again, you know, looking at this color checker, it does fare fairly well throughout. Again, you want one or less, and you get a max of 2.71 with an average of 0.8. Again, only with the single point grayscale and setting all the other basic stuff up, you are getting a really, really solid result throughout the range here.
Yeah. Before we move on to HDR, Ticker Toy Tech has a question. Is burn-in still an issue on newer displays?
It depends on the technology. So OLED actually has phosphor in it, which is what was in plasmas and CRTs. There is an element of phosphor in OLED technology, and it can wear in, it can burn in. In my experience, it's been a little less susceptible than older displays, right? As we've made displays and we've gotten better with the technology, they've gotten better at protecting displays against burn-in issues. But yeah, it can still certainly burn in, and it's certainly something that in the studios we can see it happen, and we have seen it happen where, you know, someone pauses on a frame and takes a phone call and then gets called into a meeting and they come back an hour later and there's an image that's kind of retentioned into the display. And depending how bad it was and how long it is, sometimes you can get rid of it. You can make it go away. But other times it's there and you just have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, moving on to HDR, I want to give people a look at what you found in HDR mode. And here we're only going to be looking, I believe, at 10% windows. I don't think you measured full windows in this particular case. But we should also say that when the TV receives an HDR signal, right, there's a signal coming in, it's got some metadata, it says, hey, I'm HDR. The TV goes, oh, okay, I'm going to switch my extended dynamic range into high, because that's what's required in order to play HDR in the first place. But there's another weird thing about this particular set and it receiving HDR. And I hope you know what I'm referring to, because I'm going to ask you what it is.
Another weird thing when
it's the calibration, the calibration controls.
Oh, don't change. Okay. Yeah, so it's a blessing and it's a curse all at the same time. It's, like, it's so great. I love it and I hate it. But so just to start off, so we measured the 10% window for HDR because that seems to be in the industry today the best practice window to measure, right? A lot of what's being designed is being designed around people measuring a 10% window. And that comes into play because with HDR, we're pushing these sets really hard, no matter whether it's an LCD or it's an OLED or, you know, it's any other type of display, you know, projector. We're pushing these at the limit to get as much brightness out of them as we can. And a lot of displays, you know, can't do that much that bright at a full screen or 20% or 30% or 40% window. So the industry kind of settled on this 10% window size, and that's sort of you should be measuring at this 10%. So we were like, okay, well, then there's no point really in measuring a different thing because we know it's probably not going to be very good because we can see what's happening in SDR. So let's see how it's measuring in HDR. And as you mentioned, the set, when you go into HDR mode, it will stay in the mode you're in. So let's say you're in Cinema Pro. It'll stay in Cinema Pro. And it will turn into the Cinema Pro HDR memory. Some things get grayed out, and some things are different. So if you're in extended dynamic range off in SDR mode, and you switch into HDR mode, it will go into extended dynamic range high because
automatically.
That's what it needs to do. That's exactly automatically. But one of the things that we don't like is the color temperature. So the color temperature and the advanced color temperature settings will follow it. And it's not bad, but what we find is when you're measuring that higher light, right, it's gotten so bright now, there's a slight color shift in the display. Maybe it's a click green or blue or red or two clicks, right? It's not a ton. But what we noticed was, okay, there's a small color shift when we're measuring this. We'd love to like take out those two clicks of red and just balance out this grayscale and get it just that much tighter with this higher light output. However, it then follows it back to the user menu. So you can't choose, say, Expert 1 color temp and then adjust Expert 1 in SDR, go to HDR, it'll be in Expert 1 with the same settings, and you can't set that separately of SDR. So if you were going to calibrate the display and try to make sure it's perfect, what you would need to do is you'd have to switch the color temperature manually in HDR, which, you know, how many people are really going to take the time to go in every time they're watching? Maybe if you're watching an HDR movie, you may take the time to go switch it. But if you're flicking through channels, like we hope to be in the future, and you're just watching TV and you go, ooh, HDR channel, right? Are you then going to go, ooh, let me go in the menu and start changing these things?
No, I think not.
I've had a couple of clients actually with some of these displays that do that, that don't have a separate setting, and they'll actually run an HDR source into a separate input, or they'll split it, right? So they'll say, oh, my HDR input's 2 or 3 or 4, and then my SDR is 1. And then if it's HDR, I just go to input 2 because that's calibrated. And all I have to do is hit an input button and it's really quick. So they'll use a little easier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to make it a little easier. And again, we're splitting hairs here. I mean, it's very close.
I know. And it's very close. Yes, in fact, let's take a look at number 13, which will show us you did the measurements based on the SDR calibration, but then took measurements of HDR grayscale using those same settings. And here's what we came up with. This is with extended dynamic range at high.
Yes. So extended dynamic range high, a 21-point grayscale here. You'll see we're hitting about 680 nits, 679 nits of brightness at that 10% window. Now, the top RGB balance chart is luminance, and then the bottom one is the RGB balance below it. So there are two charts, but one is showing the luminance. And the reason I did that on my Calman workflow was because we wanted to see what's happening with the tone map, right? What's happening with the lumens? And you can see the tone map happening around 70.
At 70% stimulus level.
Yes, 70% stimulus level, 70% luminance in terms of the pattern. But keep in mind with HDR, the scale's a little different, right? So 70% is 70% from the pattern, but a lot of your content might not actually be at 70% because of how bright 70% actually is, right? So it's all, right. you kind of have to think about it a little bit differently, but that's where they are performing their tone map. And it's a shallow tone map. It's not a lot. I personally like a tone map like this. I would love to, when HDR was first explained to me, right, it's going to be great. There's no more questions of gamma. One of these SMPTE engineers was telling me, he's going, you know, it's nit for nit. So like, you know, if something's supposed to be 50 nits of brightness, you calibrate it to 15 nits of brightness. It doesn't matter what the display is. It's not a power function. You know, it's actually exact. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And then we got into the whole discussion. Wait, what if my display can't do it? Well, it's going to clip it. Oh, wouldn't that look bad, right? Like people would, you know, these engineers are very smart, right? These SMPTE guys are like way smarter than I am, and they're mathematicians, and they're doing all the research, and they're doing their things. And so they kind of said, oh, well, we're going to have to do a tone map. We're going to have to roll this off. And right now in the industry, there is sort of a recommended roll off, you know, that's out there, but it's really the Wild West. Not everyone is doing a similar roll off. And a lot of companies, I think, more displays I have seen that are doing a more aggressive roll off. And even some of these displays that are brighter than this one are doing a slightly more aggressive roll off. But since most of your image is not in the highlights of HDR, or you know, most content's probably not going to be in the extreme highlights of HDR. A lot of it's going to be down around, you know, 50 to, I don't know, 200, 300, 400 nits, let's say. You're going to have a lot more content down there. So, you know, do you really want to start your roll off really low? I personally, I've had these conversations with people. Some people are like, no, you're wrong. This is where you want to do it. This is where we need to do it. But I look at some of these displays with more of a shallow roll off like the Sony, and I like it. I thought it looked great. When I looked at, I looked at Mad Max the other day on it, and that's a 4,000 nit master. And even though it's only about 680 nits, you know, I didn't realize like, oh my gosh, there's all this content that's just blurring together because of the shallow roll off, or, you know, I didn't see that when I was watching the scenes I was watching and I was trying to really push the set.
Right, right. SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room is asking, how are you inputting HDR patterns?
That's a good question, Ray. So for this, I have a few test pattern generators there. So we were using for HDR, we were using the Kona card, the AJA Kona card. Which we were outputting RGB, so it was not color matrixed, right? So if you output YUV from a test pattern generator and it doesn't have a BT2020 matrix, it's going to be improperly encoded. So then when the TV sees it, if it says, hey, I'm Rec 709, it's going to decode improperly. So then what we do is we actually go through an HD Fury integral and we inject the metadata and the proper information so the TV knows what we're sending it and how to properly process that. So we'll send the AVI info frame and the flag, right, that is going to tell it's HDR. So the TV goes in HDR.
Right.
Yeah, the HDR flag and the AVI info frame. And so it turns in HDR mode and it says, okay, this is RGB. This doesn't need to be, you know, improperly color processed, and doesn't send EDID back to the generator. That there are a couple of generators. There's one generator I have at the office, very expensive generator, but sadly out of the HDMI, it goes by the EDID only of the display. And so you have to watch. I learned this lesson the hard way, right? So you're sending it in. I'm going, why is all my color mapping wrong in HDR? Because it's sending YUV because the TV says I want YUV, but the generator sends Rec 709 metadata. So it's taking a 709 signal and the TV's then converting it using 2020, which is wrong. Then you get an error. So you're like, why is my color management so bad? Why is it going wrong? And then you figure out, okay, it's going wrong. So now we can inject it. We can control it with the HD Fury. And that's what we were doing in the office. We were using the Kona card to the HD Fury into the display. And what was driving the Kona card was Calman's, SpectraCal's virtual forge.
Okay, there you go.
I like that generator a lot.
Well, we're running out of time here. I want to jump to graphic number 17, which is the CMS, the color system, the color saturation sweeps with extended dynamic range set to high, which is what it needs to be for high dynamic range. And there we can see, you know, it's a little farther off than the SDR. And there's no CMS in the TV, so we can't adjust it. But it's not too bad, right?
No, it's not too bad. And here's the thing you have to remember. Tone mapping is on. So
right.
there is a roll-off happening here that's part of the display's characteristic of how it's processing the image, where Calman does not know what the tone map is, right? It doesn't know what it's doing. So Calman's trying to plot, well, this pattern should measure X with, you know, Y luminance, right? It should be, this is what it should be. And so that's what we're seeing here, is how accurate is it to perfection, not including the tone map. And this is something that you can play some tricks in Calman to try and get it to look a little more accurate, or kind of take some of the tone mapping out of the equation. But ideally, I think more ideally, it would be great to simply have a mode like the Z9D does, where you can turn off the tone mapping and make your measurements to see how the display is performing. Notice on this chart, though, we are measuring DCI-P3, Scott. So this is one of those situations where the CIE chart on the right, that the large triangle is Rec 2020. And right. Then what you're looking at is 25% saturation sweeps of P3. It doesn't go out to the edge of red, the edge of green, and even the edge of blue there, because it's P3 color space. And we know this display won't quite hit 2020. And this is how it's dealing with that P3, which, again, as you mentioned, is how a lot of content is being mastered today. It's very close. You know, I mean, overall, it's very close. And I think if you were to take the tone map out of it, you'd see it even get closer, because we wouldn't be measuring against that.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, number 21 is the color checker in HDR. And let's take a look at that. And we can see that. What are we looking at?
So we did a smaller color checker here, and we try to keep it inside where a lot of the colors would live, because if you start getting to the edge, you're just going to start seeing a lot of error from, you know, where you hit the display's limitation of how far out it can actually go. But again, we're seeing something that's, again, I attribute a lot of it to the tone map that's within the display and those limitations of the display itself, right? Ideally, we'd have the ability to do more light. We would need less tone mapping. This would be more accurate. But comparing this to other HDR displays, which I know we haven't talked about a lot of other HDR displays, I think it's very good. I think it's very good overall for what we're seeing out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time, unfortunately. I was going to spend a little time talking about actual content, but we're pretty well done here today. And we spent a lot of time sort of preparing people for what we're going to do in the future. And I look forward very much to doing more of these TVs with you. Next up, in fact, is the LG C7 OLED, which is their, I guess you would call it the entry-level OLED. There's also a B7, but that's what's called a captive brand. It's only at one store. I forget whether it's Best Buy or Costco or I don't know where, but it's That's going to be what's called a captive brand. The generally available entry-level OLED is a C7, which you just got into your studio and put a little time on it, I think. And pretty soon you'll get some measurements, and I'll come over and we'll talk about that. We'll look at some content and have you come back and talk about that TV.
Can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be super cool. Well, man, this has been just great. Super geeky, but hey, the show is Home Theater Geeks, so what do you expect, huh? So I'm looking forward to that again, and I want to, for now, thank you so much for being here and putting all this time in, and it's been very informative. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You bet. That's Dave Abrams. You can contact him through his website, avical.com. That's avical.com. Man, if you want a calibrator, he's the best. There's nobody better. There are many good calibrators around the country, but none better than Dave, I'd say. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can email me, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit Home Theater Geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Darren Fong of Out of Your Head. That's the name of his company and his product. We're going to be return to headphone virtualization. We talked about this last week, and we're going to come back to it with Darren about how he creates software that simulates different speakers in different rooms on headphones, so that you're listening on headphones and you think you're listening to, or you hope, we hope you're thinking that you're listening to speakers in a room. So it's really interesting, and I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.